Welcome, folksy folks. Welcome to Fabric of Folklore. I'm your hostess, Vanessa Y. Rogers, and this is a podcast where we unravel the mysteries of folklore. This podcast is about exploring the deeper meanings of what we humans do to create community, to create identity. Folklore is folktales, but it's also fairy tales, music, celebrations. Our traditions help to bind us, but they also tell our story. This podcast is about digging into that history and its significance and meaning. In one of our recent episodes, we talked to Melanie Kirkpatrick about Thanksgiving and the original Pilgrim and Native American first Thanksgiving story, and she related how some people had been taught wrongly that the Pilgrims were helping the Native Americans by feeding them, when in fact, the Wampanoag tribe provided a three-day feast for the starving Pilgrims who would have likely died without the tribe's assistance. The stories we tell ourselves about who we are create our identity. And that's one reason we'd like to dive in to the history, to uncover the roots and the significance and its messaging. So if that sounds like a podcast that you are interested in following, make sure that you hit that subscribe button right now, whether you're watching on YouTube or you're listening on your favorite podcasting platform like Apple or Spotify. Hit that subscribe button so that you get those notifications every week when our podcast drops. Our episode today is going to be so fantastic. We have a guest, Donnelly Fields. She's a teacher, trainer, and speaker in the international educational circuit and has been a primary, secondary, and university teacher. She collaborates with publishers and innovative educational organizations globally to promote student-centered learning environments. These activities and strategies can be found at her website, scaffoldingmagic.com. Dawn also has a podcast, Doorways to Learning, which highlights educators on every continent who are devoted to more active and diverse educational opportunities. Her other passion is looking deeper into the underlying messages in fairy tales. Her doctoral thesis was on the witch as the hero of fairy tales, which is we'll be exploring in the show today. We'll be talking about fairy tales and how the stereotypes we've made about the characters of the princess and the witch may in fact be wrong. We'll also be discussing winter celebrations and their related religions based off of one of Donna's lesson plans. So thank you so much for joining us, Donna.
Oh my goodness, it's so nice to be here, Vanessa. Thank you so much. I just love your missionary statement and what you're trying to explore in all of your podcasts. So let's get into it. You tell me where you want to start.
Yeah, well, thank you. So let's start with your educational background and what you're trying to do with Scaffolding Magic and Doorways to Learning.
All right. Well, that's a big one, but I'll try to, you know, pare it all down to what's really important. I became a teacher. I'm from New York City. I became a teacher in New Mexico. In New Mexico, it was very important to speak Spanish. So I came to Spain, which thinking, oh, I'll just be here for a couple of months, learn Spanish and go back. And I'm here more than 20 years later. But the scaffolding came out of my experience first in New Mexico. I was in a school that was in the middle of nowhere, except for the state prison. The state prison was the land that we shared, and we would be the third people that were called if there was an escape in the prison, which happened. First there was the governor and the mayor. In any case, the reason why I'm saying this is because the children in my classroom were the children of the prisoners in the state prison. So it wasn't the most, it wasn't the population that had education as its priority. So to me, I grew up in a community and in a family and in a larger community in which education was primary. We loved learning. And even if we didn't, we had to learn. You know, this was our mission in life. And I thought that's how everyone grew up. And when I realized that these kids did not have education as their priority, and knowing, at least at that time, that education would get them out of their dynamic and where they were probably going, I did everything I could to try to get them excited about learning. And even if I couldn't get them excited about it, I tried to sort of trick them into learning. And scaffolding came out of that. And scaffolding essentially is, they're different activities that introduce information in different ways that use your whole body and all of your senses. And so you're learning without really realizing it. You're doing something that you'd like to do without even realizing it. So it started there and it just has kept growing. And I believe in it so strongly when teachers use these scaffolding techniques, they realize how powerful they are. The challenge is getting them to use it. So that's scaffolding. There's so much more, but you tell me now.
When I think of scaffolding, I think of, architecture. Is that what you're referencing with scaffolding magic?
The term scaffolding comes out of the term to scaffold a building. So you're building a structure around a building to support it before you put in everything in the middle. And it's supposed to, if you understand that concept, then scaffolding is a perfect term. I have problems with the term. So I actually wrote a book on scaffolding and called it Giving a Helping Hand. To me, that explains it. You are giving a helping hand to students. They are giving a helping hand to each other. So either one, I know people who like the term and the image of a scaffold around a building, supporting it until all of the interior design is made. And then you can take the scaffolding away. Or what I like is, here's an activity that will build on the vocabulary or the concept or the images of the lesson you're about to learn so that you feel supported as you're moving into it. You tell me what you like more.
And is the magic part, is that the learning? Is that the education element? Is it creating the magic for the students? Is that what you're meaning?
Well, it's really interesting because nobody has ever asked me that before. And as you were asking, I realized that that comes from my love of fairy tales. And that's the other thing we're going to talk about today. So I love magic. I love fairy tales. And I put education and fairy tales and magic together and think that if you use these techniques, magic will happen. And I see it happen. So you could say, higher learning is happening. I say magic is happening.
Well, for me, I also grew up in a household where education was paramount and learning was something that we loved. It wasn't a chore. It was something that was fun. And I think when you go into education with that mindset, it is magical in that way. And so to me, that's a really lovely way of structuring education as something that is magical and exciting rather than, something that bogs you down and something that, causes you a headache or struggle. So anyways, I love that imagery personally. So let's talk about winter celebrations. You have a specific lesson plan that you've created around winter celebrations and International Religion Day. Can you talk a little bit about what got you interested in that?
Sure. It's very personal, I think. But it's also about connection. And the irony is that winter celebrations are about connection. Most of the time, it's a connection within a community. But for me, I grew up in a Jewish community, in a Jewish household, and I was very comfortable. There was a large Jewish community where I grew up. And often, a lot of times, there are isolated Jewish families. In my case, it wasn't that. So I had a very strong, very positive identity as a Jewish girl growing up. I don't consider myself Jewish now. I consider myself human in a world where there are many different religions and many different celebrations. I still have, obviously, the culture of being Jewish, which means education is fundamental. Questioning thing is fun. I mean, there's a joke, if you have two Jews, you'll have three opinions because we question everything. I question curriculum. Mm. And I questioned why we were only celebrating Christmas at school. You're in the States now. I'm in Spain. But I think when you can tell me this more accurately than I know right now, as I was leaving, it was more common to call the Christmas holidays the winter holidays, which is more respectful to everyone in the world if you call it the winter holidays. I don't know. In your area, do you call it still Christmas or winter holidays?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to. But I think in schools in general, they try and be PC and try and be inclusive. And so I believe it's called winter holidays.
Okay. So that works for me. But when I was growing up, it was called Christmas holidays. And even though it in my family and in my extended family, we were going to celebrate Hanukkah. Mm-hmm. It was called the Christmas holidays. So the idea mm-hmm. is, because I was brought up with a very healthy relationship with questioning, when I questioned mm-hmm. what we were doing in the curriculum, in the classroom, and in the school. And I remember one of my first years, I walked into the school and I saw a little Christmas tree with presents around it. And I was furious. And I questioned the person who did it. And I just asked him why it wouldn't be so easy to include a Kwanzaa candle, include a menorah, and include other representations of winter celebrations in the world. It wasn't mm-hmm. in that case that we had so a diversity of students. We were in the middle of the country in New Mexico. It was mostly Hispanic and a few white children. Mm-hmm. Even so, I thought it was very important for the children to know about other winter holidays, because we were there to present them with information to help expand their minds and perspectives of the world. And if they walk mm-hmm. into a school and only see a Christmas tree, their perspective is the world celebrates Christmas, which we mm-hmm. know is not true. Mm-hmm. So with my lesson on winter celebrations, I include as many winter celebrations as I can find, and Actually, Vanessa, the lesson was developed with a nun. I work in Spain with a lot of schools called concertados. And these are schools that are half run by the church and half run by the state and a little by the parents. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, I grew up Jewish. What do I know about Christianity, and how am I going to get along with the nuns who run the school? And it turns out in these specific schools, these nuns are incredibly well-educated and very open-minded. And it was this nun who asked me to amplify her lesson and include as many religions as I wanted to. And so the lesson that I'm going to send your listeners is this very lesson that we created together. And it's celebrating, I think we have 10 different religions in it. And what it asks them to do is look at the differences and then look at the connections, look at the similarities and mm-hmm. think what in the world sort of mirrors this dynamic, these celebrations, the coming together of a community, how these celebrations within a community separate them, and how could mm-hmm. we connect them? And that's really mm-hmm. my big goal with this lesson.
Well, I really love that. I don't think I ever had a lesson like that in school. And I think that is so important to see the world outside of your small bubble, because there's so much more to the world than where we are currently, you know, and being able to see people outside and how they celebrate different holidays and how they have different traditions is really important to understand and know, because then we just become otherwise we become, you know, more self-centered and think that the entire world revolves around us. So I love that. Can you, in the lesson plan, when I was reading, yeah, exactly. In the lesson plan, I saw that you refer to a day called International Religion Day. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. To me, the date isn't as important as everything about the date. And it's really just what I'm saying. It's an international day that someone has invented so that people would question okay. what's going on. Why are there different religions? What are the religions for? We like to think, and I'm going to be a little controversial here, because we like to think that religion is from whatever higher power we believe in. Mm-hmm. And I personally don't believe that. I think that religions come from a need to structure our lives, which is fine. That's wonderful. But we need to acknowledge that could be why there is this evolution of religions. Were religions meant to separate people? I don't believe so. My sisters mm-hmm. are very religious. I'm not religious. They like the structure. They need the structure. Wonderful. It helps them feel secure. It helps them, it gives them a path during the year of what they need to do. It gives them a community. And that's what I see with so many people. It gives them a community, a structure, a way to put their lives into a framework and see, you know, how they can play with it a little bit. And it gives them people to bounce off ideas from. It, at the base of every religion, I see love. I think that usually, if you get down to it, there is love at the basis of every religion. If we could acknowledge that, then we could realize that no matter how you're living your life, you know, the day-to-day part, then your religion is trying to help you make connections with everyone else you find in the street, no matter if they follow your structure or not. And this day of religion, from what I understand about it, is yes, is to question that and hopefully get to the same conclusions as I have, but other conclusions are very welcome.
And so my understanding is other teachers from around the world purchase your lesson plans to use in their own classrooms. Is that right?
Yeah, I have a store. And so I plan lessons. I have a lot of scaffolds. I have a few lessons, but more of their scaffolds that go into their lessons and it can complement any of their lessons. And so, I mean, they're not expensive. Teachers do not make a lot of money. And so I make them very affordable. But it takes me a lot of time to make them, and I really do value them. And so I used to just give them away in all my workshops, and now I do have a store. So I can't apologize for it, but I do say that I understand that it's an investment. Yeah.
And so I'm curious the reaction that you receive to this particular lesson plan. Do you feel like it is, or scaffolding, do you feel that it is controversial, or do you feel that it is... something that people are craving, or both?
Yeah, I love that question, Vanessa. I love it, because when I did it, the fact that I did it with a nun, thinking she would be the last person that would want to do something like that, I thought, oh my goodness, then everyone is going to be so open to this. And it got me very excited about it. And the truth is that in all the other concertados, the schools that I work with, they really did respond well to it. Until I came up with a lot of resistance, and in resistance where I didn't expect it. And it was schools that were more geared towards the church, you know, more really trenched in their beliefs. I didn't expect it. And it was a real, what can I say? I was disappointed more than anything. It was just a lesson one of the teachers shared with me, and it was just this. I said, could you share your lessons about winter celebrations with me? And I just want to say, distinguish between the scaffolding and this particular lesson. The scaffolding, the teachers usually love. They say they love them and then they won't use them because they don't know how to fit them. This is the Spanish teachers. Mm-hmm. They don't know how to fit them into their curriculum. And I make that qualification because when I work with American teachers or British teachers, they're so excited about them. I work with Finnish teachers or Egyptian teachers, very excited about them. There's a big, heavy traditionalism here in Spain, and there's a lot of there's a lot of people looking at what you're doing in the classroom, and there's less creative possibilities. But when we're talking about the lesson, this happened once, and then it happened over and over again until I am cautious about sharing it. And because your audience is more American, then they're going to be more accepting of a lot more diversity. But all that happened is one of the teachers presented her lesson that I thought was going to be diverse, and she was started with baby Jesus. And she kept talking about baby Jesus and baby Jesus. And I thought, this is exactly what I grew up with. All you need, and I said to her, could you possibly add baby Buddha, for instance, or baby Moses? I don't know. I thought that I was doing it nicely. I thought that I was doing it to make her laugh. She was furious. And she said, I'm in a school where we celebrate Christmas and Christ, and this is the lesson I'm going to share, and minded about it. You have to accept it. There's no way to push someone like that. What would you have done if someone minded this and you presented and they said something to you that you felt was a little narrow? Would you try to convince them, or would you accept it, kind of, you know, be a little bit disappointed but keep moving on? Or would you make an effort to help them see another perspective?
It depends, I think, on the person, because I think that a lot of times, you know, we wrap our identity around specific things, and people have a hard time sometimes stretching that identity, and they feel vulnerable and attacked if they perceive other ideas as valuable or realistic. I think that there is this mindset. Yes, it's threatening. And so when the person is feeling attacked, they aren't able to think clearly, and they aren't able to think openly. And so I think that a lot of times when people have those mindsets, it's harder to have those conversations without them having done the work themselves previously. I think there are some things that we can do, but and one of the things that one of the reasons I do this podcast is because I think that one of the best ways to get people to think about other ways of being and other ways of living and other traditions is through storytelling. And it's one of the most unthreatening ways to have conversations that are difficult. And so, but I think in those types of situations, it's, you know, you just have to let them do what they're going to do.
Yeah. And I think that's incredibly perspective. That's really perceptive of you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm from New York, and we are very good at expressing our opinions very strongly. And in New Mexico, I had to bring it down a lot. And I thought I had brought it, you know, been more diplomatic. She just was threatened by the whole idea. So you're right. It was something that I had to let go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times it's just little tiny chinks that come at different times in your life that cause you to start thinking in different ways. But if you aren't able to be open to those new ideas that kind of peck in and you just see them as threats, then you're unable to change your mind in any way. So it just depends on where you are in your life and how open you can be to things like that. Can you talk about how
well said
the students react to the scaffolding, the lesson plans, how they how accepting are they? Do they find it enlightening? What do they come away with?
Again, I love the question. I was actually able to be in the room a couple of times when we gave this lesson in the very beginning. And not only was the teacher, who is the nun, you know, the director of the school, she was all three of them at once. She was so excited about it. So her students were excited about it, but she gave her students the space to really explore each of the religions. And she came up with a lot of her own activities in it. And the students were so excited because it wasn't just talking about one religion. It was exploring the lights and the candles and the color and the food and the music of all these different religions. And she brought in a lot of the materials from each of these celebrations so that it was very empirical. And they could really express things because they were touching and they were feeling and they were smelling and tasting. And it was a whole sensory experience for them. What student would not enjoy that? And she did it. We both planned it so that so many different learning styles were present. There were some graphing. So people who needed the really logical side of it could see what was common in each religion. And then there was, of course, the food. And we could see what, you know, spices and sugar and something was bitter in different countries. Other parts of the world were celebrating. And they were clothes. And so she had a lot of pictures. And some of them she could bring in. And they could really, you know, try these on. So, yeah, the students loved it. I just have to say they loved it.
And so what are some of the common threads that are seen in these different religions and different celebrations?
I would say there's probably two or three common threads. The most important one is winter holidays happen in most of the countries that we're thinking of, over, you know, the darkest parts of the year. And so it's really vanquishing the darkness. So candles, yeah, fire, light is a huge, it's the most important part of it. In mm-hmm. Japan, they have this whole park where they, I mean, Japan, is they're very special over there. My sister goes to Japan a lot, and we talk about this a lot. Very, very different culture, but so beautiful. In this, I think they do it in February. They take this whole park lined with trees, and they have millions and millions of light bulbs lighting up the entire park. And it really is where people can go and feel less sad about the darkness. Kwanzaa is about lights. We have Diwali, which is throwing, which is colors and lights. And they're all about, which we really need. If you talk to Scandinavians, if you talk to people who are living in the north, they realize themselves it's too much darkness for the human being. They need to have more light in their lives. So winter holidays came out of this need, you know, the sort of pagan need to light up their life, literally. Then you have, of course, music, because music and dance will always make you feel, it brings up your vibration a lot. And then food. We don't want heavy food, so there's usually sweets, and sweets will help you, it'll give you a nice little high for a little bit, at least, and keep you smiling. So are things that will bring you together and remind you that there's, that sun is going to come back for a longer period of time. And so just hang on a little bit longer. And you have the people in your community around to support you.
So can you name, can you talk about all the different celebrations that are in the lesson plan? You don't have to go through all of them, but, you know, just to give us a little bit of some of them.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, some of them, there's Boxing Day in England, which is associated with Christmas, but it's a different sort of celebration. We have the Chinese New Year. There's Diwali, there's Hanukkah, Kwanzaa. There's Las Posadas, which is in Mexico and a lot of different Latin countries. There's Saint Lucia, which sounds like a Christian holiday, but it really is a pagan holiday that is celebrating this one woman's strength during an event. Those are the ones that come to mind. There are other celebrations, but those are the winter celebrations. And that's what we really want to talk about, right? Okay. So all of those and more.
Yeah. So I was reading through your plan, you ask a lot of really good, deep questions. And so I wanted to ask you a couple of them. The first question that you ask the students to consider, and it's very good. How might the world be different economically, socially, and politically if world leaders were more authentically tolerant of all religions and egalitarian regarding gender? So can you talk a little bit about how this question shows up in the classroom and what comes up?
Yeah, this is really interesting because so far I haven't had a teacher who has dared to try that question. They've never gotten that far. They love the whole celebration part, but they've never gotten to the part where they can ask their students to think about the question, research it, and come up with their own conclusions. It's more of a question for secondary students, for high school students. Okay. And so far I haven't, at least the teacher hasn't told me some of the conclusions they've gotten to. What I would like, my ideal, is to have them think about what a government would be like that thought was more compassionate, more empathetic. We're going to get there one day. We're not there yet. We're in sort of a vortex. We're in sort of this dark vortex of people who are coming to power that are not compassionate and not empathetic. And they're much more concerned with their own power and with materialism, and mostly men. And I am not political, so I couldn't give you specifics, but I do know that, and I encourage the younger people in the States, at least, that they need to vote, because if they don't, they're letting white men make their decisions for them. And I think largely that's true. Hopefully that's not going to be true soon, but we're in a sort of vortex in time when we are letting these men make our decisions. And it's usually, I donate to women. I donate to, when I'm in an organization called Kiva. You might be familiar with it. And what Kiva does is encourages women in especially rural areas to ask for loans so that they can create their own businesses. And the studies have shown all over the world that when the woman has more control over the money, finances, you seem to know what I'm talking about, that when the woman has more control over finances, the whole family benefits. And the children are usually fed more regularly, they go to school more regularly, they're clothed, et cetera, et cetera. It's really about the social elements of how boys and girls are brought up in different women are usually brought up to be more empathetic, and boys are usually, I'm not saying always, brought up to think about what to do with their money and their entitlement, we can say. And it doesn't, I'm not saying, and I don't believe that men can't be empathetic, because I know men who are empathetic, and I know that men care deeply about their families. But on the whole, in general, if women have more financial power within the family, the whole family does benefit. And so in an ideal world, we would have governments who think about the people instead of justifying their decisions because they want to make more money and they want to put the stress on money. And that's a very superficial way to answer that question, but it's a start.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it?
Oh, I love how you keep flipping the questions back on me. I definitely agree with you. I'm not sure I had really thought deeply about it before I saw you pose the question in your lesson plan, which is why I thought it was such a great question, because and you actually asked a lot of good deep questions in your lessons plans that I think would be quite difficult. I have a master's degree, and so I've gone through quite a bit of education, but these are some questions that require a lot of depth and thinking. But I feel like a lot of the questions that you ask are, require deep thought, because, I had to start thinking about the different governments that run countries and how they base their government, where they base their government from, and is it based in a religion? And so, there's so many things to think about when you're thinking about that question and how each element is really affecting their decision making. And so, I think having an understanding of what role religion plays in government decisions is really a fantastic question for all of us to really consider. So I wanted to get to the fairy tales, but I had one last question about the religions. And when you were doing the research, were there any elements of the traditions and the winter celebrations that came up that you were like, oh, that's beautiful, that's magical, I really would like to incorporate that for me? Were there any things that you found?
Oh my goodness, I really like that question. I wish something would just pop into my mind. But most of it is just most of it was just seeing the different faces and seeing the variety of people who celebrate. It wasn't anything new necessarily, because there's lights and there's food and there's dance and there's music, as I was saying before. But it was really the joy of seeing the diversity of people who were involved in these celebrations. And I kept thinking, I'm living in a country right now that doesn't have a lot of diversity, and I wish for them that they saw more of these faces. There's a lot of now traffic coming up from Africa, so there's a few more darker skinned people here, and the population is adjusting, and not really well all the time. But there aren't a lot of Asians here, and there aren't a lot of, you know, Indians here. There isn't a lot of diversity. So as I'm looking at these pictures, it goes back more to my childhood where there was that. So your question is absolutely gorgeous. And I think that other teachers and other people will say, oh my goodness, that's a beautiful tradition. I want to start that. Mm-hmm. I grew up lighting candles, and in Christmas, you don't light candles so much. You see lights on a tree. I love lighting a candle. The thing about holding fire in your hand and passing it over to another candle. And that for me is very spiritual and very dramatic. These other holidays, I think it really is about the beautiful communities that that celebrate them. And there is one thing with Kwanzaa, the pictures that I found, it's from ancient African celebrations. And the dress of the Africans, if they're doing it completely, just so beautiful. And you might be familiar with that too, African Americans, when they really put on the African uniform, they really own their past. It's very powerful and very beautiful. I would not look good in those outfits, but I like seeing other people with them on. One other thing I'd like to say, if you don't mind, Vanessa, before we get into, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you're wearing
pink. You're
going to
say pink sweater?
No, your shirt is a beautiful, bright color.
That's very kind
of you. I think that you would be able to pull it off.
I love color. But I did want to say one last thing about questions that you were mentioning before you're getting to fairy tales. And I think that it goes back to growing up with questions. And in all my scaffolds and all the scaffolding activities, I have this formative evaluation once they're finished. And they're lower and higher order thinking questions. And what you and I are doing right now, we're going for the higher order thinking questions. That's why I'm so engaged in this conversation, because you're letting me be creative and you're asking me questions that don't have one correct answer. It's an answer that I can give you that if I can justify, then it's wonderful. And so what I encourage teachers to do is go for those higher level order questions, because that's what we need today. Mm-hmm. We don't need our students to just answer rotely. We need them to be creative, to get us out of them. And so that's the last question, the comment I have about the questions in that context. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for letting me say that.
And that's what education really should be about, right? About making you think differently than how you were raised.
I'm sorry, some of that was cut off. Are you asking me, do I think differently now than how I was raised?
No. I think that's what education should really be about thinking outside of how you were raised. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Okay, so
well
let's
said.
Get into your doctoral thesis. And it was your witches fairy tale thesis. So tell us about what drew you to this topic to begin with.
I loved fairy tales growing up. I just loved them. I read them all the time. When I grew up, we had this huge set. I forget what they were. My sister has them now, but it's a specific set of green books, and about 20 of them, and they're filled with fairy tales. And I would read them over and over again all the time. Why? I think that we love fairy tales as children and even as adults because they give us a structure. If we want to connect religion and fairy tales, we have a structure here. So in fairy tales, now we have archetypes. Now there are archetypes we can trust. And when I say we can trust them, because if you go back even to the Grimm's fairy tales, they go back thousands of years, fairy tales, the first versions. But if you go to the Grimm's fairy tales, they're not that fun. They're not that uplifting. They are really gruesome. And what, for instance, Walt Disney did was whitewash them. And I can say that literally and I can say it figuratively. I am not a big fan of Walt Disney. I think that he made it too archetypal, too black and white. There are no nuances in Walt Disney stories in his versions. And if you only know the Walt Disney versions, you don't know fairy tales. Mm-hmm. So I grew up with a little more nuances, the fairy tales before Walt Disney. Well, what am I saying? I grew up with Walt Disney. We sat in front of the TV when we were little with our little TV dinners, and we loved Walt Disney movies. But those aren't the fairy tales that I was in love with. Mm. The fairy tales I was in love with presented the king as, you know, this benevolent person you can always trust, and the prince is always going to save the princess or kill the dragon. The witch is the evil person you can hate without apologizing. That isn't life. That isn't life. We need the nuances. Who is the king in real life? The person with money. Does that mean the person with money is a good person? I don't think any of us will say that's true. Who is the prince? Why does the princess need to be saved? I think women are pretty incredible. And I think women can save themselves and do not need a prince to save them. I think having a partner is absolutely beautiful, whatever that looks like. But we don't need, and I grew up thinking I need a prince to save me. I thought I needed a prince to make my life complete, because that's what I learned. And that's also the whole general society I lived in. You grow up and you get married and you have children. And I thought, I was very lucky that I didn't have a father who kind of gave me that idea that he was waiting for me to get married and have children. My sisters did that. My brother did that. So I was okay. But he didn't put any pressure on them either. But the idea is that fairy tales give us a structure where we can feel safe. But my impetus about studying them is why. I like to look beneath the lines. And I was an English major in college, and I became a literature teacher afterwards. And I like reading between the lines. So that's how my doctorate came about.
Can you define fairy tales?
So shall I explain a little bit about the witch?
Yes, but beforehand, can you define what you see as a fairy tale?
Oh, wow. Wow. I'm trying to think if I've ever had to answer that question. Fairy tale or folk tale, between the two, for instance, or a regular story? You know, Vanessa, I'm not sure if I can answer that really well.
Well, for you, your mind.
Okay, I will say, I'm going to try to save myself here. I'll try to save myself. Yeah, okay. So a fairy tale has archetypal characters. Yeah. And one thing I learned by doing it, I'm trying to find the book behind me, is that there are patterns. And a fairy tale will have the same pattern in different cultures all over the world, all through the centuries. And so a fairy tale for me will have the archetypes, will be telling an underlying message, will be giving you a message. It's not like a book of fiction that you pick up and that's what it is. The message is right there. The fairy tale, you need to look a little deeper. And it's a statement about society as well. So that for me is a fairy tale. I think I've just saved myself.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the archetypal characters. You mentioned the king, and then who else are archetypal characters in your fairy tales?
Okay, well, the king is usually the person who everyone looks to for benevolence and for protection. You have the queen that's usually non-existent, who is either dead before the story begins or dies in the first lines of the story. In other words, she's innocuous. She doesn't threaten the king at all or anyone else. You have the prince, who is supposed to be noble, and he's either supposed to save the kingdom or save the princess. You have the princess, who always has to be beautiful, usually doesn't say much. And actually, if we're going to go back to Disney, the princess has almost no words. She almost has no dialogue. Then we have the witch, and the witch can be an ogre or a monster or a troll or a woman or the stepmother. Sometimes she's named the witch. Sometimes you just know that she's the witch and the evil person that you want to hate. So those are the archetypal characters.
And in your thesis, you mentioned that we have prejudices against each different archetype. Can you talk a little bit about those prejudices that we develop?
Sure. And in today's lingua, I think we'd call them profiling. And I think that I talked a little bit about the fact that police are trained to be profilers. Police are trained to profile. And in my mind, I see that as coming from a household or the system, you know, becoming a policeman where you have to profile to get your job done. And I think that that's not with all policemen or policewomen, police agents. But unfortunately, in the United States, we have so much profile going on because it's easier. So if you go to an archetype and you read a fairy tale, it's very easy to love the king. It's very easy to feel that the prince has done his job because he's killed a dragon, he's killed something, or he saved the princess. Nobody's asked the princess if she wanted to be saved. Mm-hmm. Or hey, we hate the witch. And it's so easy to see things as black and white. And the same thing is the archetyping patterning in the world. It's so easy to hate someone. What's not easy is to see that no matter what anyone does that is despicable, something about them is also good. That's not easy to balance between those two extremes. So if we have the archetypes in fairy tales, and if we read them a lot and people celebrate them when we're young, we think, oh, then it's fine to see people as black and white. It's fine not to try and see their goodness when they're acting aggressively to us. That's not human experience that I think we're supposed to be celebrating. And Vanessa, if it's okay with you, let me just define archetype so that I'm explaining archetype and profile at the same time. There are a lot of different definitions of archetype, but I'm going to take, and I hate saying this because it's the Jungian definition. I'm not really a fan of Jung, but we'll just use that. And it's a collectively inherited, unconscious idea. It's a pattern of thought that's universally accepted in an individual. And where does that come from? You know, another way to say it is a prejudice. Very easy. So a prejudice can be positive, a prejudice can be negative. And unfortunately, I think we've extracted from fairy tales a more negative use of archetypes that has turned into profile and has turned profiling and has turned into an inacceptance of differences and diversity. And that's where I don't have problems with fairy tales, but I have problems with people who don't read fairy tales for what they're supposed to be, which is a statement about society, not a literal interpretation of society. Does that make sense?
Can you define what the distinguishing features would be?
Sure. I mean, just as I say, the king in the story is benevolent because he has a lot of money, he has gold, he has a castle where people feel safe. In our world, a person with money is not necessarily generous. They're usually often they're the opposite. Not someone you necessarily trust just because they have money and they have a big house. Why would you trust someone just because they have money in a big house? Why would you not trust someone who lives in a little cottage? You know, it doesn't make any sense. If we read a fairy tale because we enjoy it and because it's easy, wonderful. But don't take away from that's what life is all about. Mm-hmm. We need to understand that there are challenges. My doctorate is about the witch is a challenge. Any challenge you have in life is the witch. And it's up to us to decide how we were going to face that witch, that challenge. If we face it and see all of the different facets of that challenge, the witch, then we're going to come out growing ourselves. We're going to come out feeling very good about our ability to assess something that's not so easy. But if you look at a fairy tale and say, the witch is someone I can hate, and I'm just going to hate anyone who does anything that I don't like, that to me is a misinterpretation and what is not necessarily appropriate to use the fairy tales for.
Okay, so let's get into your thesis then. What is the crux of your thesis?
The crux is just that the witch is a challenge. The witch is the heroine of the fairy tales. I'll give you an example. You have Snow White, for instance. I mean, I love Rapunzel, but I've talked about Rapunzel in a different podcast. If you want me to go into it, I'm more than happy to, but let's go with Snow White because it's a little simpler and I can explain it with a little more fluidity. Snow White, make sure I'm getting this right, because sometimes I mix up the fairy tales. Snow White is beautiful, and the stepmother, who is the witch in this case, is threatened by her beauty and sends her out into the woods, and she's supposed to be killed. Mm-hmm. Well, there are different facets of that. If you read the Walt Disney version, you can hate the witch because she sends this poor little beautiful girl out into the woods, and she bites an apple eventually and goes to sleep for, what, 100 years until the prince kisses her. If you read other versions, it's absolutely fascinating. The stepmother actually sees that the father, who is sometimes the king, is a little more attentive to his daughter than he needs to be. And so what she does is she separates her poor stepdaughter from the father, who is not old enough to know what's going on yet, and saves her. She secludes her. She makes sure that she is in a different place than the father during the day and during the night. And so she is actually the heroine of the story because she is protecting her stepdaughter. We don't usually read that version of it. Mm-mm. Another way to read it is that Snow White is at the point of puberty, and she's feeling her sexuality. She's learning, she's feeling all these hormones going through her body, and she doesn't know what to do with it. And she's in a small little town, and she would make wrong choices. So the stepmother actually sends her away, makes her, drugs her somehow, and usually it's an apple, so that she can sort of absorb her new sexuality before she goes out in the world, and she will make better choices. Again, versions that we don't usually read, and they make a lot more sense than, so again, it's the witch being the heroine. It's looking beneath what's going on the superficial and resolving the situation as well as she can. So those are very simple ways to see the fairy tale. The witch is the heroine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, talk about Rapunzel. I'm interested now to hear about how the witch is a heroine in Rapunzel as well.
The heroine of Rapunzel. Okay, so you probably know the story. The story starts with Rapunzel up in a tower, and she has this beautiful golden hair. And whenever the witch wants to go up, she says, "Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your golden hair." Rapunzel does it. The witch climbs up, and she takes care of her, you know, does whatever she needs to do. In some of the older versions, we find out how Rapunzel ended up in that tower. How she ended up in the tower was because her parents, her mother was pregnant, and she had these cravings. And what you read, ponchigo, which is Spanish for a specific type of fruit that only grew in the witch's garden next door. And instead of knocking on the witch's door and asking if she could have some of this fruit, she asked her husband, the king, to go over and steal the fruit for her because her cravings were so bad. The witch catches the king and says, "You're in my garden without permission, you can have that fruit, but in exchange, what will you give me?" And the king says, "I'll give you my daughter." Fine. You know, it's just something that is so inappropriate, but he wants to appease his wife more than he cares about his daughter. So just initially, what we can say of that is the witch had seen that these were completely narcissistic parents, were not appropriate for this girl, and she was going to bring this girl up with, and I will explain this in a minute, with education and culture and with agency. So the reason why I say that is because she takes this girl, she secludes her in a tower, but what's in the tower? In the versions we don't usually read, the tower is filled with books. And the tower is filled with weaving and music and all these different ways for Rapunzel to expand and to develop all of her skills. And so she's in this tower because she is beautiful and she would get unwanted attention. And the witch does not want her to feel that her beauty is what she needs to value herself by, but rather her intelligence and her musical skills and her craft, you know, the skills that she can make things with. Mm-hmm. The witch wants her secluded so that she learns that what is inside of her is more important than her actual physical beauty. Mm. So it's another way of seeing the story. I love the story more because of these other versions. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate the witch. I mean, she's still not the nicest person in the world, but her underlying goals, her motives are to make sure that this girl values herself, her insides, instead of just her the exterior, and she's not herself. Mm-hmm. That's why I love the story about Rapunzel so much.
Mm-hmm. So where are these different versions coming from? Where are the origins of these different fairy tales?
Yeah, when I do webinars for publishers, they want me to have books behind me because they say that it looks like I'm more professional. But what most people don't know is most of these books are fairy tales, and there are just hundreds of them. These versions come from thousands of years ago. When I was doing my doctorate, I found old Chinese versions, Japanese versions, Welsh versions. Everything has past versions. There's, let me see, this book, which is The Types of International Folktales, and I had the honor of meeting this author, Hans-Jörg Uther. These are two volumes that have hundreds and thousands of different versions in them. So what I did, my thesis encouraged me to do, is to read as many different versions as possible, because the most recent versions are filtered through what society is accepting now. And that's fine if you want to read a fairy tale to your children now. But if you want to research it, what we need to know is the underlying message. So these versions, as I say, you can have a Cinderella version now, the Walt Disney version. But if you go back to the Grimm's version, the two stepsisters, in the Walt Disney version, for instance, you have the two stepsisters who tried to put their foot in the shoe, but it didn't fit. And we just see them, you know, trying. In the Grimm's version, the stepmother cut off one of the toes of one of her daughters, and she cut off one of the heels of the other daughter so that they would fit into the shoe. And, you know, there's blood spurting all over the place. Those aren't the versions that we really want to think about, because what we want when we think about a fairy tale now is, oh, what's a sweet little story we can tell our children so they'll go to sleep? That's not going to do it if you have blood spurting out all over the place because these girls have their, you know, appendages being chopped off. But for instance, in Asian versions of the same story, you'll have the witch is a monster fish, because in Japan, for instance, you have much more contact with water. So the archetypes are different forms, which is also fascinating. But again, it's just that there are different ways that things happen depending on the society when that story was developed and told.
And so what is your thoughts? What are your thoughts about the different messages that are being portrayed messaged to society through the different tellings? Are we trying to change how we perceive the story? And are we changing what message the children or adults should be garnering from these stories? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's interesting because I don't think I had a conclusion until you just asked me that. And what I see is that the easier and more black and white, you know, less nuanced a story is, the easier it is to swallow and the less that we have to analyze. And so in a crazy kind of world, it's easier to see. And this is what's happening politically. And again, I'm not political, but since we were talking about this, in this world, we're seeing so many more black and white governmental parties. And it's so much easier to say, oh, I hate you because you're part of that party. And I only will trust people who are part of my political party. That's not going to help us. I have the tendency to do that as well, but that's not going to find connection. And if we go back to the Winter Celebrations, what I am really big about doing is finding connections. So the versions today of fairy tales, why do we like Walt Disney so much? Because it makes us happy in a really crazy world. Things always work out well. People always ask me why I like Hollywood movies. Because they always work out well. You know, I have enough in my life that is so uncertain. Let me watch a movie that turns out well and I'm good to go. If I need to watch a movie where there's just two more questions at the end, I don't need to turn on the TV or go to the cinema. You know, so I'm not saying that it's a bad thing. It's something we need to recognize. What is it? Your question is amazing. What is it that we're looking for in these stories? Me, I'm looking looking for hidden meaning that will help me become a person that is more accepting, more empathetic, and be able to connect more. Mm-hmm. If we could all do that, that would be amazing. What about you, Vanessa? What do you think you're looking for in these fairy tales? You have three children, right? What are you looking for in fairy tales?
Well, it depends on if I'm reading them to them or to myself, because I would not want to read the original Grimm fairy tale of Cinderella where, you know, the stepsisters are cutting off their limbs, because if that feels traumatizing to me, and I feel like there's enough trauma in the world that I don't need to expose my children to more gore and violence than is necessary. But right. I do, when I read fairy tales, I am always curious about what the intention is. And if there was an intention to begin with, because, you know, the Grimm fairy tales, my understanding of fairy tales and folk tales is folk tales were orally told tales that were passed on through generations, and they changed with the tellers, right? And so when the Grimm brothers went around Germany, they collected all of these folk tales and they put them together in a collection, and they called them fairy tales. And today, there's a lot of blurry lines, but a lot of times people say that fairy tales are written by an author. So, you know, there's, rather than like them coming from oral fairy tales, oral tellings, but it's, you know, there's a lot of blurring between those lines. It's not clear cut black and white like you were talking about before. But I forgot what the question was. I feel like there is things that we're supposed to get from these stories, and that the tellers or authors are wanting us to accept about either ourselves or society or our roles. And I as well personally enjoy looking for those messages and what the people of those times were thinking and how our thought processes have changed as well. And so, that's what I look for when I'm reading all of these tales, these folk tales.
I mean, Vanessa, tales. If you think, I mean, well, I think simply, I think part of what you're asking me is one thing we didn't really address, and where some of the, let's say, fairy tales in the medieval times, and we can talk about Hansel and Gretel, and you think about these two little children who were sent away from the house. That actually happened. That actually happened. There was not enough food and there was enough money to buy, to take care of children at that time. There was no, there was no birth control. So if you had children that you couldn't support, people actually left their children in the woods. Now, wouldn't it be nice to think that you left your child in the woods and they found this incredible candy house there and they were taken care of afterwards? Mm. That's a gorgeous thought. If you think about medieval times, and there were no pleasantries, there was no technology. So it was difficult to wash clothes. It was difficult to light fires, and it was difficult to get water. So wouldn't it be wonderful if you have these little duendes or elves or little helpers to take care of, clean the house and make all the food for you? So there are those fairy tales, and it's a way of imagining a world that's easier. And it's also a statement about the nobility and the injustices and, you know, the feudal system, and it's venting in a safe way. You were killed if you went to a noble and said you're being very unjust, and you were killed if you were hunting on someone's land. They decided it was their land when, you know, it was woods and there were animals there. And I'm a vegan, so I'm not really crazy about the hunting idea, but you understand what I'm talking about. So it was a way for storytellers to vent, and it was a way of people to be around a community and listen to these and laugh about the injustices and feel that there was a way to sort of get your emotions out in a little bit of a safer way than what you really wanted to do. And that was storm the kingdom or storm the nobility's house, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that is really what you were trying to do. You started another podcast called Fairy Tale Flip. Is that right? Where you are really looking at fairy tales in this manner.
Yes. And I'm not sure if I'm going to continue it. I love doing it, but I really work well with someone like you asking me questions and then I can respond to them. If it's just me sitting in front of the camera, I go off on tangents thinking I know what I want to say, but I'm going off on a tangent. I'm not sure if my listeners are going to follow me. So I'm going to continue. I'm going to think about continuing it. I really am passionate about my Doorway to Learning podcast, which is talking to educators and commenting on education. But yes, again, you have asked me questions about fairy tales, and all once again, they're just rolling through my head. I get so excited about it, and I'll have to make a decision. Maybe you and I will work on Fairy Tale Flip Friday. We'll see.
Maybe. Well, yeah. So I know we covered a lot and there's probably a lot more to cover, but is there anything else that you feel like we missed?
I mentioned this before. Your questions are so insightful and they're so inclusive, and there wasn't anything that I thought I'm missing. So hopefully we heard everything we really wanted to ask. I'm exploring things that we often don't really appreciate. This whole conversation, and I'm going back to Heidi, and you're giving other people the opportunity to explore a different perspective of an idea that you probably have an opinion on, but you are just very open. So I really appreciate this whole space that you've created.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. And I really appreciate you coming on the show and, you know, talking about all of these different elements that you are working on, because it's, you know, exactly what we are looking for at Fabric of Folklore. So thank you so much for joining us, Donna.
Thank you so much, Vanessa. We'll talk again soon, hopefully. And your listeners, thank you all for considering all these ideas.
And thank you, folksy folks. All the links that we talked about today will be at my website, fabricoffolklore.com, including the PDF that Donna is going to gift everyone as a gift for listening today. And we want to know what your thoughts are. What did you take away from today's conversation? Have you read old fairy tales, and have you seen the witch actually being the heroine rather than being the villain? And what winter festival sounds fun to you? What winter celebration sounds like it touches your heart? We want to hear from you and continue that conversation either on our YouTube channel, where you can comment down below, or on our Facebook community group page, where you can comment and tell us your thoughts about the most recent episode. So I really enjoy hearing audience feedback, so I really encourage you to continue that conversation there. And if you are enjoying the show, please subscribe and follow us, whether that's on YouTube or if you're listening on your favorite podcasting platform. We're also on social media. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, and we're sometimes on Twitter X. I just call it Twitter X because no one really calls it X. So thanks so much for joining us. Once again, my name is Vanessa Y. Rogers, and until next time, keep the folk alive.